Something that we nurture here is deeper roots, further reach, meaning that more grounded someone is in their faith tradition, their worldview, more they will offer to the world, bigger impact students will have. You're not asked to give up on part of yourself, but you're encouraged to actually bring that to the table. As part of this approach, we encourage our students to model the world they want to live in, not to mirror the one that we are in.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. It's easy to say we want the world to be better than it is and that we can do that by being kinder to one another. That's true. And that's one thing if there's a neighborhood dispute about a fence line or an off-leash dog, but it's something else entirely when it really is a life and death struggle. And our guest today somehow still models and hopes for a better world despite literally growing up in a war zone as a child. You may remember the civil wars and wars of secession that inflamed what we once knew as Yugoslavia. In the mid-80s, I got to go to Yugoslavia. It was beautiful. And then the sadness of seeing those news stories during the 1990s about those bitter battles between the different ethnic groups who eventually broke apart into Croatia, Macedonia, Bosnia, and Herzegovina. So it was with some wonder that I listened to the story of Imam Amir Duric, who survived that heavy conflict as a child and the poverty that followed and continues now to love and serve God. One of his outstanding qualities seems to be his ability and his willingness to listen to different people with different perspectives. Imam Amir Duric oversees the Muslim chaplaincy at Syracuse University, an educational program supporting Muslim students, faculty, and staff. Originally from Bosnia, he's previously served as imam in Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and the Delaware Valley, Philadelphia region. In September of 2024, his impactful work earned him national recognition as an Interfaith Innovation Fellow by Interfaith America, selected from over 200 applicants.
Well, whenever I have a chance to be part of conversations that are beyond what I believe or my own values, I eager to participate and to learn. I always prefer listening over speaking. And sometimes I find it a challenge, but also it's a strength because it allows me to learn from others and it allows me to grow in many different ways. So opportunity to participate in One America Movement Summit was really great opportunity and something exciting. And I just wanted to expand my network of interfaith partners and seek new opportunities to collaborate and to also explore various ways how I can contribute to our diverse society, but also how I can be in conversation with those that already do outstanding job out there.
Well, I felt that too, that I met people who were so open-hearted and so many who had years and years of this work that I felt like they could teach me just by sharing their stories. I grew up seeing the conflict in Serbia and Bosnia and the whole former Yugoslavia. The fact that people had at one point been splintered along ethnic and religious lines there. And then you went to Sarajevo, and I read that you saw communities learning to coexist with each other. Tell me about that background, and is that part of why what you do now?
It certainly is. Because I was a child during the war in Bosnia and experienced worst of the worst. And as a child, learned sound of shells and bombs over my head. And as children, we knew when to hide, when it was safe to keep playing as shells are going over our heads. But that was reality of my life. So much uncertainty, not knowing what next moment will bring, what next day will bring. Learning about my neighbors, relatives who were killed, observing funerals for them. So it was all part of reality. But the question that I held was, why this all happens? And then later on in my life, I learned how religion can be weaponized, how it can be used to turn people against each other. Because before that war, we had Yugoslavia. And nobody could imagine, for example, in '84, as Olympic Games were happening in Sarajevo, that country can get split apart. And less than a decade later, after the beautiful Winter Olympic Games in Sarajevo, Sarajevo was in flames. And religion certainly played into it, because various players and our leaders, religious and political leaders, use religion as a weapon to turn people against each other. And then after the war, again, religious leaders played a very important role in bringing people and communities together, because I don't think, and it's part of my experience as well, that we have a choice when it comes to coexistence. Right. Only question when we start to cooperate and when we start to talk to each other and how we want to frame our values. And I learned, especially in challenging times, using religion and a strength is a powerful method to overcome that challenge on a personal but also communal level. And I was part of some initiatives in Sarajevo. But also, it was part of my studies, comparative religions, world religions, and then engaging with various communities in Sarajevo. Some call Sarajevo European Jerusalem, because we have churches, we have mosques, we have synagogue. Jews exist in Sarajevo since 15th century. So there is really so much that Sarajevo offers, and I was blessed to be part of that experience.
When you first arrived there, were you surprised to find yourself meeting people who were, quote, from the other side or different, and then making connections?
I certainly was surprised. And reason for that is that part of the country where I was born, it's not as diverse. And then going to Sarajevo, probably assumption was that I will find something similar or same. And then you start learning that actually someone that you interact with is of a different background, or they share a different worldview. In most cases, it just brought value to what I already was doing or what I knew about the world.
You know, one idea that came out from the very first session at the One America Movement Summit was in the opening session, where they said, all of the faith traditions around the world already have the answers for how to build community. We just have to learn to use them. And I think that's what you do. I think you have seen that religion can be used by politicians and others to divide people and create enemies and war, but it's a whole other thing to actually use the tenets of our own faiths that all tell us how to treat each other. What was it that drew you into not being just an imam or a leader in the mosque, but to pursue chaplaincy?
Well, it is caring for other people. Part of my lived experience was always caring for others. And then also being imam in New Jersey, coming to the US and being imam there, serving community, I learned about chaplaincy as a field. And I just found that to be something that is almost organic and that can complement my work. And I met with one of mentors who asked me, do you go to this state prison in Trenton and volunteer there as a chaplain? I said, no, I don't. He said, there are many inmates actually who are Muslim who do need support. Why don't you sign up and start volunteering there? And it is how I started my volunteer work in the state prison in New Jersey and did it for 3 years. That actually was opening for my learning about chaplaincy. And then enrolling in a program at Hartford Seminary and wanting to become a chaplain, because I learned it is about caring for others, it's about art of listening, it's about presence. And I just thought, this is what I need. This is what can help me become better in what I do.
I wonder if we could go back just a minute. What was the home like that you grew up in? Was your family very observant in Islam?
I would say female part of my family. So my mom, my grandma, they were very observant. They would observe daily prayers every day, and I was able to see it as a child. Then as I was learning, I would join them, and my mom would always call me to join the prayer. And I had times where I was a little annoyed by that. I would be in the middle of a game or playing outside, and then I had
like
to leave it.
That sounds like a typical child.
Yes. So, but I'm so grateful now for that. However, male members of my family, they were working more in various industries, and they were more observant in month of Ramadan, as all Muslims are, because you pay attention more. Some call this spiritual boot camp, and you really try your best to reconnect with the divine and to grow spiritually. My grandfather especially, he has a wisdom that shaped my entire life. He asked me to do call for prayer outside of the house in month of Ramadan. He would ask me to lead prayer in the house as I was in elementary school. And this instilled love for religious leadership in my heart. So I started saying from first grade of elementary school that I will become an imam. And I never changed my mind. So it shaped actually my entire life. I would say he was more spiritual, and my father also was more spiritual. And when you combine being really observant, if I think about my mom and grandmother and their wisdom, and then the spiritual parts of my grandfather and father, it gave me exactly what I needed.
Was your grandfather still living when you became an imam? Did he live to see that?
Yes, he was over the moon. He was very happy. And I actually also started being imam in New Jersey when he still was alive. And then I went back to Bosnia to visit. And I think he had a feeling that he will pass away soon. So in our tradition, we wear special gown and cap. So it is white and red. And then when you think about imam in Bosnia, especially even in America, in a typical Bosnian mosque, you would expect imam to wear that. So when I went to visit Bosnia, and it was last year of his life, he asked me, did you bring that from America? Did you bring your gown from America? Because who knows what can happen, and I will need you to lead my funeral. And I said, no, you still have time. And actually he died and I didn't have my gown. I led his funeral, but I didn't have my religious gown.
I love that you said he was over the moon. I just think he would have been so proud to see the fulfillment of something that he had maybe helped instill. Is that unusual to ask a child of that age to lead the call to prayer outside the house?
It almost is. Even if you try to do that, not many children will comply, be able to do that. But he had a reward system and he was able to motivate me to do that. I was proud to have opportunity to do that. And he knew how to reward it. And then I kept doing that. And then soon after, at local mosque, they started asking me to do call to prayer in the mosque. So within a congregation of hundreds of people, they would call my name and ask me to do that. I don't even know how I had courage to do so. So if you do call to prayer, they open a window on second floor of mosque, and then you do a call to prayer. So I was that short and young that I couldn't open window myself. So an adult would accompany me to open window and I would do a call to prayer. And then later on, when they built minaret next to mosque, I remember running up to the top to do that. So it was so exciting.
So you're part of a tradition here. When did a connection with God feel real to you? Did it always, or was there a point later in growing up where you had to decide, do I really believe this? So what was that like for you?
I would say I had times in my life where it was reconfirmed. I never questioned it. I started practicing in a young age and then probably playing some leadership role. I found that remarkable that I wasn't in that place to lead prayer. So for example, if a child is born, they would ask me to come and do prayer for newborn. You can imagine me elementary school and then middle school and then going in somebody's house to bless a newborn baby. I don't know how I was able to do that, but I wasn't aware what actually that meant at the time. But later on, as my life was evolving and as I was going from one place to another, for example, going to boarding school and then to pursue college degree, which many students from my middle school and high school couldn't do. So that life journey was almost affirmation of God's presence in itself. Most days in elementary and middle school, I would go to school and have one Bosnian mark, which I could use to buy a sandwich or to buy a drink. I never could have both together. And thinking about that child who had so much uncertainty and that I didn't know first in the war if you're going to survive or not, who had life under the sound of shells and bombs, and then very difficult and challenging life afterwards. And when I think about my undergraduate studies and then coming to the United States and being where I am now, there is no way that anyone could do that for me besides combination of God's blessings and, of course, will of good people. But also, if all people came and told me back then, 15, 20 years ago, you will go with us and you will be here now, I couldn't imagine that. So as I was going through that process, I wasn't probably even aware of that. But as I reflect on various chapters of my life, I can clearly see God's intervention in it and God's presence in all of that. And each one of those phases was just deepening my faith and making my connection with divine stronger. And I'm so, so grateful for that. But throughout the life, faith was a coping mechanism all the time. Even as a child, I learned that if a family member dies, you need to re-engage with the prayer. And something that I had from early on in my life was engaging with the scripture. So Quran itself is in Arabic language, but in weekend schools, in mosques, in Bosnia, you start learning Arabic letters. Early in middle school, I was able to read from the scripture in Arabic. And I became really good at that. People would ask me to do it, but I always found that even if I often didn't understand what I was doing at the time, I found that to be profound. And it was helping me calm down if I was anxious. It was helping me find some solace if I was going through a tough time. Early on, I didn't have best understanding of that. And later, it became clear what kind of role it played and what it really meant for me.
Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I Love is Real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea, which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show. And you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is In Good Faith. We're speaking with Imam Amir Duric, Assistant Dean for Religious and Spiritual Life at Syracuse University.
I'm wondering if there is a particular surah or a particular story or a verse that you have held on to that's very meaningful to that you could share with us.
So one that they memorized early on, there is about 11 pages. It is Surah Al-Kahf or The Cave. So it is recommended to read it every Friday. And then it's believed if you do it on Friday, you get light on your face that will shine in your life between two Fridays. So as I was a student in weekend school, on Fridays, I would go to congregational prayer to the mosque. I would just walk up the street for 2-3 minutes and I am there. And then also in Islam, while we can pray 5 daily prayers on our own, it's highly recommended that we pray with congregation, and that such prayer is 27 times more valuable. So Imam at the mosque, he would ask me, did you read Surah Al-Kahf today? And if I did, I would be so happy. I would proudly say that I did. But if I didn't, I would be somewhat embarrassed. He would kindly say, okay, why don't you go home and do it? And I would go home and I would do that and then run back to next prayer to tell him that I did that. And then I realized after a couple of years that I memorized the entire chapter. Another one that is dear to my heart is Surah Al-Waqi'ah. It is probably a little under 3 pages. And it is believed that if we recite this chapter every night, that we will never experience poverty. So I had a phase in my life where I was going through uncertainty, was waiting for the US visa as I was waiting my R1 visa. So it was over a year that I didn't know if I'm going to get it or not. And I had job offers in Bosnia, but I gave my word to the community in New Jersey, and I didn't accept those offers. And then still, I just got married before that. So you have family, you have responsibilities. And this was time when I was, okay, what my life will look like if this doesn't happen, if I miss those opportunities that I have. So I started actually reading this chapter every night, and I also memorized that. And it gave me some comfort that I will be able to figure it out. And I did. Things played out better than what I anticipated.
I'm curious, when you work with Muslim students who, I mean, they could come from anywhere, but many raised here and born in the U.S., what are their concerns that you see from the college-age students that you work with? What are their challenges right now as far as faith goes?
Well, many families, but also students, as they're considering which college they're going to attend, one of important things that is considered is what kind of support is out there. Is there any support when it comes to practicing Islam? Is there Friday service on campus at a specific university or college? But then also, how many of Muslim students are there? Are they going to be able to find community? And then also, what kind of accommodations are there when it comes to, for example, observing Ramadan? Is there anything offered where students can know that they will have morning meal ready for them, even if it's pre-prepared? Are they going to have community to break fast with them? And those practices are definitely something that almost everyone considers, but finding that community and what kind of support is out there. There are many other challenges that come with it. Sometimes challenges is really a completely different environment. So if you're coming from a traditional family where there was oversight of what children will do, what kind of friends they will have, so now you're almost giving them away and who they will find, who they will connect to. As we say here, you're the average of five people you hang out with, right? So having community where you can feel that you belong is very important. And I would say it is one of biggest questions, but also challenges to find that community of belonging. And then once you find that, it's a blessing for many Muslim students and families.
Imam, you were recognized as an interfaith fellow by Interfaith America. I wonder if you can tell me about the types of interfaith activities or work that you've done that brought you to their attention.
Something that we nurture here at Hendrick Chapel at Syracuse University is deeper roots, further reach, meaning that more grounded someone is in their faith tradition, their worldview, more they will offer to the world, bigger impact students will have. And it helps with practices. It helps be who you are and live your values. It gives you confidence. It helps with that sense of belonging. But then also it helps engage with others because you know you're encouraged to cooperate with someone and your values will not be challenged because you're asked to bring to the table what you have.
Some people who see you engage in dialogue, especially with people who've been at war, might see you as, quote, consorting with the enemy, just for being willing to talk and listen. So how do you not disavow your own views, but still engage in good faith dialogue? We say we want dialogue, but it's so hard to do that in emotionally charged situations. I mean, I have family members who were caught up in the emotions surrounding October 7th, understandably, because one had dear Palestinian friends, and the other was dating an Israeli-American who'd served in the IDF. So you get it. But you had to try to bring people together, Israelis and Palestinians, and even had to decide, was that possible or advisable? How did you do that with the event you had planned even before the Hamas attack in Israel on October 7th?
You're not asked to give up on part of yourself, but you're encouraged to actually bring that to the table. As part of this approach, we encourage ourselves, but also our students, to model the world they want to live in, not to mirror the one that we are in. So we try to model our values and to bring our students together and to really use our faith traditions as a source of strength, as something that can create value and that can invite others to become part of what we do. One initiative we did, it was planned before October 7th, but then October 7th happened, was almost jeopardized. It was at risk. It was a Jewish-Muslim dialogue that I planned and co-founded with Rabbi Ethan Baer. who is former rabbi of Syracuse University. So we planned that in June of 2023, and then October 7th happened. We plan to offer that in February of 2024. As you can imagine, it really became a question, can we now do it with everything happening? But we also were really good friends. We had relationship. And this is another piece that is very important to hear somebody's story and to build relationship, to sometimes free up ourselves from things that we may not even be aware of, and to meet each other first and foremost as human beings, and then to get to know each other as human beings, and then get to something that might be probably more challenging. So I had good relationship with Rabbi Ethan Baer, and we were able to have conversation in midst of dynamics and challenges in the aftermath of October 7th. And we said, no, it's even more important, actually. Let's go for it. We know it will be more challenging to recruit participants, but this is part of modeling the world that we want to see. And let's develop probably an alternative. Even if it was with small number of students, it became something that was different and that was inviting students who had different worldviews, perspectives, and understanding of what's happening, especially in the Middle East. So we had students who had opposite spectrum of views, but they still came together. They met each other. They developed some kind of relationship, and it was appreciated. So those who were part of that experience, they were very grateful, and they shared how meaningful that was for them.
Thank you for your time today. I wonder, is there something I should ask you that I don't know to ask?
Well, I would probably just conclude and bring it all together with mentioning that it's really a blessing to be a part of Syracuse University and Hendrix Chapel. And when I think about ideal world out there in our diverse and often polarized society, I share example of Hendrix Chapel, because at Hendrix Chapel, we really live interfaith cooperation. It's part of our lived experience, our day-to-day experience. And it is something that we aim to share with the world, because it's helping us reach over boundaries that often are imposed on us to live in our own bubble, in our space. So Hendrix Chapel, what we have here, what we do here, helps us speak over those differences.
Many thanks to Imam Amir Durich for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Heidi Clough, Nick Levitt, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast, and subscribe to our YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith.